Arrest him on what charge? Malik snapped. The plan was to detain him on Tet Yaroa. That was close to being illegal, but I was ready to take that risk. But I cannot order our handful of people at Alphonsus to arrest the man without some clear criminal charge against him. A criminal charge, and not this confiscation matter. Gaetano steepled his fingers in front of his face, the cigarette held between forefinger and thumb. Squinting from behind the smoke, he suggested, "Shoot him down, then, before he gets to Alphonsus. Get rid of him once and for all." Malik started across the carpet again. Gesuto, he's going to wear a path through it, Gaetano thought.
He has Jane Scanwell with him, the Russian growled.
What?
Gaetano nearly jumped out of his chair. She's with him. We know that much. We can't kill the American representative to the council. She's a former president of the United States, for God's sake.
She's gone with him willingly?
How should I know?
Gaetano smiled and spread his hands in a happy gesture of fulfillment. There is the answer to the problem. Randolph has kidnapped the American representative to the council. Kidnapping is an act of terrorism, according to the international law, is it not?
Malik stopped his pacing and stared at the younger man.
Yes, of course. Kidnapping!
For the first time that morning, he smiled.
You see, there is a solution to every problem.
The Russian's smile eroded.
But Scanwell might say that she went with him voluntarily.
Do you think there is such a possibility? Malik took the leather chair in front of the desk.
I don't know. They were lovers once, from what I've heard. Perhaps she still loves him.
That would be a complication.
Yes.
Gaetano brightened.
But you could still arrest Randolph on suspicion of kidnapping and hold him until Scanwell gave an official statement to the security people at Alphonsus.
Malik's smile glimmered again.
Or hold him until a special investigating team can be assembled and sent to Alphonsus.
Exactly.
That would take a week, 10 days, perhaps even longer. And by that time the confiscation procedures will be completed, and Randolph will be a man without a corporation.
Gaetano took a long puff on his cigarette, thinking, You see, I have worked out the entire problem for you in less time than it took me to smoke one cigarette. But he said nothing of the kind aloud to Malik. All during the long flight to Alphonsus, Dan had to force himself to stay away from the radiophone. He wanted to give orders to his people in Alphonsus. He wanted to fry the ass off Kate Williams. He wanted to find out what was going on and how far Malik and his GEC snakes had gotten with their confiscation order. But no matter how much he fretted, he kept silent. Maintain radio silence, he repeated to himself 10,000 times. Don't let them know for certain that you're aboard this bucket on your way to Alphonsus. But he could listen. For hours on end, he sat with his headphones clamped on and had the OTV's captain tuned to the business chatter between his office at Alphonsus and Astro's terrestrial headquarters at Caracas. What he heard was not good. GEC executive orders had already been filed, notifying Astro management that the corporation was to be confiscated. Teams of GEC administrators had already invaded the Caracas offices and several other facilities elsewhere on Earth. It was only a matter of days, perhaps hours, before they showed up at Alphonsus. Again and again he heard his top staff people grappling with the problem as best they could, always asking, Where's Dan? We need him to fight this. Where's the boss? Why isn't he available? Where the hell is he? Nobody knew. Dan fumed in frustrated silence as the OTV plied its fixed trajectory toward Alphonsus. Malik hit it just right, he groused to himself. The Russian son of a bitch knew my people couldn't meet this threat effectively without me to okay their decisions. And my own goddamned insistence on secrecy has just muddled things worse. Nobody to blame but myself and that double-damned Russian. At least his board of directors had called an emergency meeting in Tokyo. No, Dan corrected himself. Nobo's on the board, and he's pissed as hell with me. Will he let his personal anger get in the way of his business sense? Christ, I really could lose everything I've got. Jane slept a good deal of the time they were in transit. Dan tried to nap, but could not. The captain came down and fixed himself a meal at the little galley built into the side bulkhead of the passenger deck. Later on, the co-pilot came down and prepared a tray for herself. "You ought to eat something," Dan told Jane, halfway to the moon. "How's your stomach?"
"I'm fine. The medication seems to be working, but it makes me feel drowsy."
"Psychosomatic." The corners of her mouth curled upward slightly.
"We didn't get all that much sleep last night on the island, you know."
He grinned back at her. "You're bragging." Gesturing to the headphones floating aimlessly beside Dan, she asked,
"How are things going?"
"Piss poor."
"From your point of view or mine?"
Dan stared at her a moment, adjusting his thinking to recall that they were on opposite sides politically. "My point of view," he said. "Malik's steamrolling through my people. He's got GEC teams taking over all my offices."
"At Alphonsus, too?"
"Not yet, but they're on their way, I'll bet."
"Have you given any thought to what you're going to do once we get there?"
Dan shook his head. "Not much I can do. Not legally. I doubt that Malik would listen to any offers from me to negotiate."
"Probably not," Jane said. "He's got the upper hand. Why should he give away anything?"
"And you're on his side, really?"
"I've got to be, Dan."
"It won't work, you know. Malik's way won't work. Not in time. They'll move too slowly. They'll want to have everything properly organized, everything neat and exact. We don't have the time for that kind of bureaucratic bullshit. We have to move fast. Now, move." Jane shook her head.
"We can't afford a chaotic approach to this. We need organization on a global scale."
He stared at her. "Christ, you really are one of them, aren't you?"
"I suppose I am," she said.
"So you're going to let him set up his dictatorship while the world goes to hell in a greenhouse?" Firmly, she answered,
"I am going to help the Global Economic Council to coordinate all the human race's resources, all of them, off Earth as well as on the planet, to avert the disaster that is threatening us."
"And grind me up into little pieces in the process," Dan said. She reached out to touch his arm.
"Dan, just because you're losing your corporation doesn't mean that your life is finished. You could help us. Help me."
"What do you want me to do?" he snarled. "Run for President of the United States for you?" Her face went white. Her nostrils flared. Finally, she said,
"No, Dan. As far as I'm concerned, you can go to hell."
15. It was a gray day in Ulaanbaatar, although by craning his neck and looking up high, Altan Lodoy could see that the sky above was the perfect clear blue for which Mongolia was famous. Tourists flew in from all over the world to see that brilliant cloudless sky and the endless desolation of the barren Gobi. Too much of Mongolia's economy depended on tourism to suit Lodoy. Whole clans dressed up in costumes out of the great Khan's era and lived in round felt gers like nomads, while the foreigners taped pictures and called the mobile tents yurts, their Russian name. All the days were gray here in the capital, he thought as he stared out the window. 5 million people have crowded into the city. Their automobiles and heaters and cooking fires draped Ulaanbaatar in a perpetual canopy of choking, foul-smelling smog. He wrinkled his nose, even though inside the Capitol building the air was filtered and cool, and almost as lovely as a spring day out in the grasslands of his home. Altan Lodoy was the nation's minister for the environment, the youngest member of the powerful inner cabinet, and the least likely to be listened to.
"His Excellency the President," called the cabinet secretary as the door to the old man's office swung open.
Jamran's Jin tottered in. A little bald man with a perpetual one-sided smile caused by a stroke that had nearly killed him more than a year ago. But the president of the Mongolian Republic was as tough as they came, physically. The only visible reminders of his stroke were the smile and the slightly uneven stumbling of his gait.
"Be seated, gentlemen," he said as he took the slightly raised high-backed padded chair at the head of the gleaming conference table.
Lodoy and the four other members of the inner cabinet took their customary chairs, Lodoy at the foot of the table. Each of the men wore Western-style business suits. Even though Lodoy yearned for the old days of legend, it would not have occurred to him to wear anything else.
The secretary sat himself slightly behind the president